Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
We begin today in Washington, where the Supreme Court just ruled on a major abortion case. The court struck down a Louisiana law that required doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, the effects of which could have left the state with a single abortion clinic. Now, we're going to be watching the court all week. There are a number of high-profile cases up. So here to kick us off is Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always good to be here.
So, Judge Gertner, there are a number of big cases remaining before the court still, correct?
Right, that's right.
How many big ones are left, and when will they be done?
Well, when will they be done? One doesn't know. Usually they try to end but at the end of June. There's some notion that because there are numbers of cases that need to be decided more than usual, that they may well go into July. But the critical ones are the ones that deal with President Trump's records, the two subpoenas from the House for the records of his of third parties, that is to say his accounting firm, and then the records that are required by subpoena by Cyrus Vance, who's the district attorney in New York, for a grand jury proceeding. So those are the ones that are still up in the air that directly address the president's power.
Okay, so now let's put this case in context, this Louisiana case. What does the verdict say, and how big of a deal is this ruling?
It is a big deal in the short term, but the opinions and the variety of the opinions suggest that it's a much more fragile victory than might otherwise appear. So in this case, Louisiana had a regulation requiring doctors to have admitting privileges in hospitals within 30 miles of the abortion clinic. The rule before had been they either get admitting privileges themselves or they can have sort of designate another doctor with admitting privileges. The rules changed to make it clear that the doctors who perform abortions themselves had to have admitting privileges. The district court held a hearing and determined essentially that if that rule were enforced, there would only be one abortion clinic left in the entire state. The standard is whether or not the legislation puts a substantial burden on the right to abortion. There had been a case only a short time ago in Texas involving almost exactly the same statute. And clearly, Louisiana passed the statute that it did in the hopes that the court would reexamine that Texas case. Instead, four members of the court, we call them the four liberals, although I always object to that, plus Justice Roberts ruled that the Louisiana burden was identical to the Texas burden, and therefore, if the Texas burden, the Texas statute was thrown out, then the Louisiana statute should be thrown out. The four dissenters.
So there are a couple of things.
Go ahead.
Well, there are a couple of things I want to dig out in there, Judge Gertner, and then we'll come to the dissenters in a second. Here in the Commonwealth, our abortion law is fairly stable and well codified. And yet this case, which deals with Louisiana, is relevant for all 50 states. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's relevant for the federal protection of abortion, the federal framework for the protection of abortion. In Massachusetts, as a result of a case before the Supreme Judicial Court in 1980, the right to choose abortion was protected under the state constitution. So even if the federal Even if Roe v. Wade were reversed tomorrow, there would still be protection for abortion in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and any other state that had interpreted its own constitution to protect the right to choose. So we're not directly affected here.
So the way this does play out that is relevant both for the Commonwealth and other states is about Roe itself. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, as I said, but even if Roe were reversed, my view would be that we're still protected in Massachusetts, but certainly because of the state constitution, but certainly around the country, One of the ways in which abortion has been undermined in the country is, I like to describe it, through a thousand cuts, not directly challenging Roe v. Wade, but by creating a host of regulations that essentially limit it, and the Supreme Court has largely upheld those limiting regulations. This is a right like none other. It's a right that essentially can be undermined. The Texas case, in which there was also requiring admitting privileges for abortion providers, was one of the first that, in which the court finally held, with Justice Kennedy joining the four, the court finally held this restriction went too far. This admitting privileges restriction went too far. And what happened today was Justice Roberts, who had been in the dissent in the Texas case, concurred almost holding his nose. If you could characterize a judicial decision as holding his nose, that's what he was doing.
So let's come back to that now. Right, so now we can talk about Roberts and we can talk about the dissenters. I do just want to note quickly, your name was on a friend of the court brief arguing in favor of keeping with legal precedents. And that's really at the heart here of this battle between those who are dissenting and those who were in the majority here, is about the question of respecting legal precedent. Am I understanding that right?
That's right. There is a framework, set of legal standards for evaluating when a proposed restriction on abortion comprises, as the law describes, a substantial obstacle to a woman's right to choose. And while Roberts, this suggests the fragility of this decision. Roberts dissented to the Texas case, to the Texas statute that was almost identical to the one here. He's now gone along with it in this case, effectively holding his nose and saying precedent is precedent. The four dissenters would unravel that precedent completely and impose different ways of analyzing abortion regulations that would essentially eliminate the right, as I said, through a thousand cuts. So the issue is whether you stick not just with Roe v. Wade, but whether you stick with this way of analyzing when regulations burden a woman. And you have four saying, yes, this is a virtually identical case. Robert saying, yes, this is a virtually identical case to the Texas case. And so precedent suggests I have to go along with it, even though I don't agree with it. And then the four dissenters picking apart the precedent and suggesting that all of this should be reevaluated.
Now, many in New England remember Maine Senator Susan Collins saying that Justice Kavanaugh would, quote unquote, follow precedent when it came to abortion rights when she has supported his nomination. I think there were probably many in other states who were expecting a different outcome from the court at this point. So where do we stand on our assessment of how the court relates to questions of choice and abortion now?
Well, I don't think there's any question that in the appropriate case, Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch will vote to either regulate abortion out of existence or reverse Roe v. Wade. I don't think that there's any doubt. In fact, in an earlier case involving something completely unrelated, which is the right to a unanimous jury, the court overturned an earlier precedent. There was a decision by Justice Kavanaugh talking about the circumstances under which you overturn precedent, and by Justice Kagan saying that has to be very limited. And it's clear that that was a discussion that was really not about the unanimous jury issue. That was a discussion about Roe v. Wade. So both Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch are willing, indeed, I would say anxious, to reevaluate this precedent, namely Roe v. Wade.
So the last thing that's coming up for me in this, Judge Gertner, is Judge Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, who has, in what appears to be a number of cases over the last couple of weeks, sort of sided with what one would call, you said you didn't like this term, but I'm going to use it here, the quote-unquote liberal justices on the court. What is going on there?
Well, it's the judicial equivalent of kicking the can down the road here. And down the road until there really is a dramatic change, even more dramatic than there already is, in the makeup of the court. In the DACA case, he literally kicked the can down the road by saying not that DACA was wrong, but that the passage of but Trump's executive order eliminating DACA didn't follow the rules of the Administrative Procedure Act, a technical act that deals with how one changes regulations. So you didn't do it right this time, Trump, is what essentially he's saying. In this case, he's saying this statute was identical to the statute that we just affirmed only a short time ago. I'm obliged by precedent to therefore to make the decision in the same way, which is throwing out this statute. These are very limited decisions and almost inviting another round, and there will be another round.
And last question, briefly, you talked about these big questions about the president coming up, the subpoena questions. Do you have a sense of what you think is going to happen there?
You know, I hate to predict. I mean, let me say others have predicted that the House subpoenas will not be upheld, but the Cyrus Vance subpoena, the criminal investigation in New York, a subpoena to have financial records going before a grand jury, that will be upheld. Who knows? But that's the prediction. And there's one sort of analysis of Roberts as the institutionalist that says, okay, we'll keep the lid on this court, this now very conservative court, for the most part, until these cases, and then the lid will come off.
All right, that's Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Thanks.
Thank you.
Communities of color in Boston are disproportionately affected by evictions. A new report from MIT and the housing advocacy group City Life Vita Urbana shows that Black communities are particularly vulnerable. Now, a state moratorium on evictions put in place due to the coronavirus pandemic is going to likely expire in mid-August, which means Black and brown renters could be facing massive housing vulnerability. With the next rent due date just around the corner on Wednesday, July 1st, we're going to delve into the implications of the report. Let's start with one of the co-authors. Joining us now is Justin Steele. He's an associate professor of law and urban planning at MIT. Justin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Are you worried about making rent? Are you a landlord who relies on rent to make your own mortgage and tax payments? Have you seen evidence in your own experience of racial bias in evictions? What's on your mind? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Justin, you did this report with some colleagues, David Robinson, Patricia Kafferke. Can you give us the top line of the report? What is the big finding for you?
I think there are two primary findings. The first is that 70% of market rate eviction filings are in census tracts where the majority of residents are people of color, even only about half of the city's rental housing is in these areas. And even beyond that, 37% of market rate eviction filings occur in neighborhoods where a majority of residents are Black, even though only 18% of rental housing is in these neighborhoods. So that means that evictions are two times more likely in neighborhoods where a majority of residents are Black than we would expect if evictions were evenly distributed across the city. And so these disparities are related to socioeconomic status, but our statistical analyses find that even after controlling for census tract median household income, poverty rate, and the share of income paid to rent, eviction filings are still more likely to occur in census tracts where there's a larger share of Black renters.
Meaning that race can be explanatory.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I noticed you used the term market rate a couple of times there. Can you blow that out for us a little bit? Why are you using that term specifically, and what are the implications of the fact that these are market rate evictions, do you think?
Yes, yeah, so we focused on evictions in privately owned rental units that are rented at whatever the market rate is and wherever that apartment is or home is. And we excluded public housing and publicly subsidized housing, which is often privately owned but publicly subsidized, because we wanted to have a conservative estimate, because often because of policies about where public housing or subsidized and continuing policies about where or neighborhood opposition to the location of subsidized housing, you often have subsidized housing concentrated more in communities of color in Boston. And so we wanted to see for market rate units, looking more conservatively at just market rate units, are there still racial disparities in eviction rates? And we found that there are.
So how do you define an eviction in this report? I know you used Boston Housing Court filings for your data.
Yes, so that's a very important point. We're focusing on eviction filings, and specifically filings that are filed in Boston Housing Court. And so that is a larger number than actually executed evictions, but it's a smaller number than the number of what are often called informal evictions. So many times landlords tell tenants that they want them to leave or that they have to leave, or if they're overdue on their rent, that they have to leave without actually going to court to file an eviction filing. So in other research, other scholars have found that there may be twice as many informal eviction filings as formal ones. And then when landlords go to court to file for an eviction filing, if they do that, that's the numbers that we're analyzing. And not all of those end in an executed eviction, but often they end up in settlements kind of in the hallway of the courthouse outside the courtroom. But those settlements often end in tenants being forced out, even though it's not recorded as an executed eviction because they've settled it out of court.
So, Justin, you use data from 2014 to 2016. We're 4 years in a global pandemic later. Let's focus on the pandemic portion. How do you view your data through the lens of what's happening with COVID-19?
So we also did look at data for the roughly 7 weeks between the identification of the first COVID-19 case in Massachusetts and the implementation of the statewide eviction moratorium in April. And the racial disparities in eviction filings in that 7 week time period are actually even larger than they were in the 3 years that we studied previously. And during that time period, 78% of all evictions filed in Boston were filed in neighborhoods where a majority of residents are people of color, even though that's only about half of the rental housing units. So it suggests that in this time of extreme economic dislocation where many people have been laid off, or unable to work the hours they need to maintain their incomes, that we're already, you know, even before the moratorium, we were starting to see that these disparities are getting wider. And I expect if the moratorium or when the moratorium is lifted, the racial disparities will be even more dramatic and troubling.
Well, that's Justin Steele, Associate Professor of Law and Urban Planning at MIT. Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now, to respond and offer his perspective, we want to bring in Doug Quattrocci, Executive Director of Mass Landlords, a trade group representing landlords in the state. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Doug.
Thank you, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
So, Doug, with this report, the map of where evictions are happening, it's pretty striking. Do you think racism or systemic racism play a big role in evictions?
Well, yeah, I mean, the report is not fundamentally surprising. We have a serious problem in America, and no less in Massachusetts, with a set of policies, housing policy included, that are systemically racist.
So, I've got a caller ready. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I, if you had a second half to that thought, I think it's important that I hear it, so go ahead.
Well, I mean, the report is one thing, and the report that was published leads us to a set of conclusions which are basically not related to race, things like rent control, extending the moratorium, free attorneys for renters. I just wanted to say that I think if we're really going to address systemic racism in America and in the Commonwealth, we have to have policies that take race into account. In other words, we can't address a problem of racism with race-neutral laws.
Let's take a call from a caller who wants to talk about policy. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Steve on the line from Natick. Steve, go ahead.
Yes. I'm calling not only about the fact that there's racism and it's systemic in the state and the country, as well as other part of the world, but with regards to COVID-19, what's happening with that, and rent as well as mortgage payments. I was just wondering if anyone has floated the idea of giving people the option of putting those things on hold or perhaps just making partial payments to help cover, say, real estate taxes or water utilities. Because I remember from
Great, thanks
when,
for that.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me take it back from you there, Steve. Thank you, because there are some answers to that. And Doug, I know that you're aware of what some of the supports are for landlords. We've got an eviction moratorium at least until mid-August, and there have been some state funds to help people pay mortgages and rent. Are there other public policy initiatives that you're advocating for or want to see that will lessen the strain on both renters and landlords in terms of mortgage payments, rent payments, other financial liabilities?
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of it reflects a lack of understanding of how housing providers operate, that we should be focused on extending mortgage forbearance or utility forbearance. So those things would matter. But when you're considering whether you should rent or buy, you know, you're looking at your rent and you're looking at the mortgage payment. The mortgage is half of the cost of renting a building for a new building typically. You've got your mortgage, but you've also got insurance, taxes, repairs, utilities. And it doesn't really make sense to try to onesie-twosie figure out how to whack down expenses. What we really need is just to have the state come in and guarantee that all of these rental housing costs will be paid for. No one should have to leave their home at any point, even after a moratorium ends. So the money piece of it is really important, not just because we're landlords and we're greedy. That's a stereotype, right? Housing isn't free. And these expenses, especially municipal taxes, which pay for infrastructure and first responder budgets, these are really important. And the state has to come up with an answer for how those costs are going to be paid.
I'd like to grab one more call here, 800-423-8255. We've got Mitchell on the line from Wellesley. Mitchell, go ahead.
Thanks. I just wanted to comment as somebody who owns a property and is being affected by the moratorium that I really don't think any landlords are looking to evict people who have been good tenants just because they're having some financial difficulties right now. The problem is that you've got an ongoing, indefinite inability of landlords to recover rent from their tenants if they stop paying, with no help from the state to help with that. So the landlords have to continue paying their mortgages, property taxes, insurance, water for the tenants, maintenance on the buildings, but they don't have the money to do it. And so there's a lot of talk going on about imposing or extending the moratorium for up to a year, but that's really a devastating burden to put on the landlords who, you know, want to do right by their tenants, but at the same time have to be getting the income. And I'd be
Mitchell,
hoping
thanks.
To see some help from the state on that.
Thanks. Let me take it back from you there. There's a lot going on here, Doug, and we have limited time, so I want to kind of bundle that together in a two-part question to you. One, this report controls for a lot of variables and shows that unequivocally, based on the data, people who are people of color face higher chances of being evicted. We now have this pandemic that is creating cash flow crunches for both landlords and renters. We also know in the Boston Globe article over the weekend emphasized a couple of stories where people were facing potential eviction because of market rate housing rents were being raised before the pandemic. We are in a perfect storm here. What is the path forward that does not pit landlords and renters against each other and that recognizes, as you acknowledged at the beginning of our conversation, the systemic racism dimensions of how housing works?
Sure. Yeah. So I think it's important that we look not to the recent past where some folks are saying rent control will help, because rent control had a known and measurable disparate impact on people of color. We had about 24% of our residents in Cambridge were people of color in the 70s and 80s, but only 12% of rent-controlled units went to people of color. And that's because of the systemic racism that maybe we don't have time to get into. But the big picture systemic racism that we really do need to address long-term is single-family zoning in the Commonwealth. Minneapolis recognized that their single-family zoning was, by origin, by intent, racist, and they had terrible things written to their deeds about who could live there. Massachusetts has been more circumspect about the origins of zoning, but we have the same policy baggage here. So this single-family zoning business needs to be addressed. And short-term, extending the moratorium is, as we heard earlier, just a way of kicking the can down the road past elections. We need funding. There needs to be funding to provide rental housing to all of us impacted by the pandemic, and it needs to be much bigger than anyone's talking about. We're talking about order of magnitude $1 billion, and the most I've heard anyone talk about coming up with is $50 million. So we tie those two together by proposing a transfer tax on single-family zoned property that would go into a fund that would pay for the rental housing guarantee that we need. We call that proposal a fair and equal housing guarantee via surety bonds.
I have to ask you, the gaps between those two numbers are so massive. Will something like your transfer tax proposal, could it close the gap? And if not, what is going to happen?
Yeah, it will. I mean, you look at people who study issues like the black-white wealth gap and how much money across the entire country is needed. And I've seen very careful work that says nothing less nationwide than $1 trillion of reparations or something similar is going to address this issue. In the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we can realistically raise order of magnitude billions of dollars from a tax on single-family land. It's most of the housing that we have. Rental housing providers are an extreme minority, and renters are in a minority too. Most people have their own home in the Commonwealth, and that restrictive land use has really got us to the point where we have a housing crisis, and now that we've got a pandemic too, it's just looking really bad. So we need to be thinking big, and we need to be thinking about landscape-changing proposals.
Well, we can keep our eye on that proposal, and if and as it moves forward, we would obviously want to host a debate for all sides of that here on the air. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for your time today. That's Doug Quattrocci, Executive Director of Mass Landlords, which is a trade group representing landlords in the state. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So now we turn to Lisa Owens, who is the executive director of City Life Vita Urbana, a housing justice organization and part of the group that did the report that we began this segment with. Lisa, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much, Tiziana.
So Lisa, in a Globe article this weekend, you warned of a tsunami of evictions that are coming. How bad will this be?
It's bad. It's bad. So, you know, you had Justin on earlier. And based on the data that Justin shared, we know that the communities that will be hardest hit when the moratorium is lifted are the exact same communities that we feature in our report. And as probably most people know by now, Massachusetts Housing Court is estimating 20,000 eviction filings immediately. And so that really is, as you said before, a perfect storm. You know, when you think about the eviction moratorium possibly being lifted around the same time that we anticipate a second surge, knock on wood, it doesn't happen, but it is likely to happen. So yeah, it's pretty bad, and we have to act now, preventatively.
I don't mean to sound despairing, but are we capable of acting on the scale to be effective against a wave as big as the one you're talking about? And how do we get there?
So I want to remind us of the distant past, March 1st of this year. It seems like such a long time ago. But
it seems like another lifetime ago.
It seems like another lifetime ago. But, you know, in March, the Massachusetts Homes for All Coalition, which brought just so many groups across the state, small homeowners, small landlords, renters, legislators, all came together and did what would have in other times been the impossible. We enacted in 5 short weeks the strongest piece of housing legislation I think that our state has seen in a decade. And that was because we all came together and we realized we have a public health emergency that we all have to figure out together. And, you know, so the fact that we were able to do that at the beginning of the crisis makes me hopeful that we can actually enact even bolder change for homeowners and for tenants and small landlords together.
You know, there is a rally this weekend to extend the eviction moratorium. There's also legislation that'll be filed by 2 representatives in the State House to expand the moratorium by 12 months, providing mortgage deferment and funding for small landlords who lose rental income. So some things that could help bridge the gap caused by the pandemic. But this report talks about a set of issues that predated the pandemic, and one will believe if we don't make change post-date it, if it's even a way to imagine what a post-COVID world will look like. How do we get at those core issues, and how do we not get distracted from also addressing those core issues when we have such immediate and overwhelming need right in front of us from the pandemic?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Our report does a really good job at naming how we got here in the first place, right? So naming what systemic racism looks like and how to dig ourselves as a city and as a state out of the hole that we find ourselves in. And, you know, I guess I just have to say up front that racial justice is housing justice. So systemic racism is not individual level discriminatory behavior. Systemic racism is both the actions of private market actors writ large and public policy. So public policy that was race specific, like redlining, but also public policy like urban renewal and predatory lending, where you don't actually let the homeowners know I'm discriminating against you, or foreclosure, or gentrification. So private market actors plus public policy equals systemic racism, and you address the generational legacy of systemic racism with really good public policy that addresses the impacts, right? And so I think, you know, our report talks about a number of policy solutions. I want to uphold the one that you just referenced, Tiziana, the Act to Guarantee Housing Stability, that's going to be filed by Representatives Honan and Connolly tomorrow. So this act immediately supports the people in the communities who are going to be the hardest hit by the second surge. And immediately after the moratorium is lifted, it provides protections from COVID-19 related eviction and foreclosure. It provides a fund to specifically help working class homeowners, working class small landlords, and renters to recover from their financial hardship. There are a number of provisions that will address immediately the hardships that we're going through now and provide protections for a year of recovery. That's really what we're hearing across the state. People need immediate protections and they need long-term recovery.
All right. Well, this is something we're going to continue to watch, and I hope we'll have you back on again soon, Lisa, to talk about it. That's Lisa Owens, Executive Director of City Life Vita Urbana, a housing justice organization. Thanks for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tiziana.
In an effort to show how executives of color can lead on eliminating racial inequities, a group of Black and Brown business leaders in Boston have come together to create the new Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund. The goal? To, quote, provide essential support, resources, and thought leadership, end quote, for uncovering and dismantling systemic racism within institutions in Boston and across the Commonwealth. So joining us to talk more about the fund is one of its founding members, Dr. Maisha Minter-Jordan, who's also the president and CEO of the DentaQuest Institute for Health Advancement and Catalyst Institute, and also a former member of the WBUR Community Advisory Board. Dr. Minter-Jordan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me. Maisha is totally fine.
Okay. What is the goal of the fund and how do you get there?
So in terms of the financial goal, we're seeding it with $20 million, and our goal is well beyond that. And in terms of the goal outside of financial is really, we recognize that it's the first time in Massachusetts that Black and Brown corporate leaders have come together to create a fund of this time. We know that we understand the obstacles of people in color in Boston and throughout Massachusetts because we're facing these issues or have faced them in the past ourselves. We have the leadership experience and a track record of success within the corporate world and across our state and beyond. And we feel like this is the time for us to step up and to be leaders in this space of bringing those corporate dollars, philanthropic dollars to communities of color, to organizations that are led by Black and Brown leaders that understand the needs of the community and have been doing incredible work, but have largely been left out of the network of organizations that traditionally receive philanthropic dollars. And so we really want to broaden that conversation. We want to highlight the organizations that are doing incredible work on behalf of people of color and work with them hand in hand to really start to move the needle on some of what we see has been longstanding systemic inequities for communities of color.
I know you wanted to start with a seeding of $20 million, and I believe the long-term goal is $100 million. How far along in the $20 million are you right now, and what are the sources? Where's that money coming from?
So there are a number of sources. We're very close to hitting that initial $20 million seed. I think part of it is from the individual contributions of the core members who started this organization, started this movement and this initiative. and as well as their corporations. So the DentaQuest Partnership for Oral Health Advancement, my company is contributing, gotten in match from DentaQuest, and we're really looking at every angle of every corporation throughout the Commonwealth to step up to support their leaders of color who are in leadership positions, but also those who may not have leaders of color in those leadership, key leadership positions, to step up and to support this effort. And we also recognize that there are many other funds. You know, the mayor of Boston kicked off a fund, and we think that there's a need for multiple funds. We are, you know, really trying to erase 400 years of inequities, and so one fund isn't going to do it, but we feel really good about the corporations that have already stepped up and look forward to many more stepping up to support our efforts.
Well, you mentioned Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's announcement last week of a fund, the Boston Racial Equity Fund. He's also announced a new equity cabinet member within his administration. I'm sure that there are those who will see these as complementary and also those who will see these as competitive. Why two funds, and how can those two funds leverage each other and work together most effectively?
So we believe that we need, as I mentioned, multiple funds. We need more than two funds. We need a collaborative effort across the Commonwealth to make sure that we have more hands on deck who are going to work on what is a deep-seated problem. We've been in contact with the mayor's office. We're fully supportive of his initiative. Our fund is not only Boston, it's the Commonwealth. And so we've been in touch with the governor's office. We've been in touch with our leaders like Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley to support our efforts. So we believe that there are multiple approaches to what is a very complex issue that are needed. And we hope that corporate donors don't look at this situation as a small pie to be divided among many groups. We think that the pie needs to be larger, and we think that we all need to double down on efforts, not only for financial resources, but thinking about diversity, equity, inclusion at every level, from the board, from the constellation of the board, through leadership. We hope that this is just the beginning of a broader conversation that needs to happen across the board.
We're talking to Dr. Myesha Minter-Jordan about the new Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund. Discussions about creating better racial equity in philanthropy over the last 10 years or so have focused a lot on not only changing who is making the decisions about who gets the money, but also being much more creative or changing the boundaries around how the money gets spent, whether that's doing more cash transfers to particular families or communities, or changing what governing boards and advisory boards look like to put people who are closest to the problem, giving them choice and control over the money. So in addition to this fund, how are you thinking that you want to change philanthropic practices more broadly by example?
I think as we lift up the leaders of Black and Brown organizations, or organizations that primarily serve those communities, to give them the visibility and the ability to be part of the network of organizations that traditionally receive philanthropy, I think is an important, so what we hope to be an important outcome of our efforts. We want to bring visibility to those programs who haven't traditionally had that. We want to be able to help them grow their infrastructure to be able to document outcomes and to document impact, understanding that systemic change is hard and that we often measure incremental change. But we think that it's part of a broader conversation about how we think about measuring system change, how we engage in communities and community leaders, engage them as part of creating the solutions, and rather than making assumptions about what those communities need without having that adequate representation at the table. And so our goal is to really create a shift in all of those approaches.
You know, you talked a couple of minutes ago about you don't just want two funds, you want many funds. We have some very significant philanthropic dollars already here in the Commonwealth, in Greater Boston, you know, Barr Foundation, Pilot, Boston Foundation, a number of others. What do you want to see happen differently in these institutions, which have traditionally been white-run institutions, to respond to the call of what the new Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund is trying to put on the table?
I would say I want them to join us. I want them to not only support our efforts, but also bring their expertise to the table as to how we can better engage a broader community of organizations and leaders. I want us to work together to uplift those leaders and provide them with the tools and resources that they need to be successful. I want them to include them in the broader conversations about systems change. And so I think there's a real opportunity for collaboration across the board in terms of the, engaging the philanthropic community with this effort, as well as engaging our corporate leaders with this effort. So I'm all about, and I think all 19 of us are really clear that this is a time in which we need to come together and we need to break down the silos and have real candid discussions and make sure that these tables are inclusive. And if we can leverage our positions and our positions within our companies in order to do that, in order to move the needle on that, then that is, we will consider ourselves successful to some extent just by virtue of starting that.
And in our last minute or so, are there specific policy dimensions, aspects of inequality or social injustice that you want to see this money move toward first?
Yeah, so we've chosen four initial areas on which we're going to focus: policing and criminal justice reform, healthcare equity, which is obviously near and dear to my heart, as are the others, economic empowerment, and youth education, empowerment, and civic engagement. So we are laser focused on those areas initially, and as we get this work underway, we'll consider broadening it past those four pillars, but those are the pillars that we've come together around, and we're extremely, extremely excited. The energy of this group is fantastic, and the level of collaboration that we've been able to establish amongst us in a very short time, I think, is something that we haven't seen before. And we are already getting calls from other cities across the country who are looking at how can they do something similar to what we're doing here in the Commonwealth. And so I expect this to be a movement. This is not a moment in time. This will be a sustained effort, and we are looking for others to come to the table and join us in this effort. That is critically important.
That is Dr. Myesha Minter-Jordan, one of the founding members of the New Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund, also president and CEO of the DentaQuest Institute for Health Advancement and Catalyst Institute. Thanks so much for joining us today. It was good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
We have some big news for the New England Patriots breaking this week. Let's check the score with Chris Siderek. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana. All right, I got the cliche question for you. We got good news and bad news. Which do you want first?
Oh, you always start with the bad news. Always start with the bad news.
You never know these days. I don't know. All right, so the bad news is the NFL finally delivered the penalties for what some in the media, I don't like to use this word, but it's been called Spygate 2.0. I don't know if you remember last season, a Patriots film crew got busted filming the sidelines of a Bengals-Browns game. The team has maintained from the beginning that this was a film crew that was independent of football operations. They put out a statement saying basically this is a team that does these do-your-job videos, kind of a behind-the-scenes thing, and they were getting the life and times of a scout, basically advanced scouting. But the league cracked down pretty strongly against the Pats here. They announced that the team would have to pay a $1.1 million fine. They lose a third-round pick in next year's draft. And the Pats TV crew is not allowed to shoot any games for the entire 2020 season, assuming, obviously, we have a 2020 season.
Okay, so I can hear three different type of fan voices in my head. One being everyone who doesn't like the Patriots saying, it's about time the Pats cheat all the time. One on the other side saying, I love the Pats. This is ridiculous. This is overblown. And then I don't actually know what the third one would be.
Well, the third one's me. The third one is
okay,
me. How's that?
So tell
because,
me.
Because I do
tell
feel
me.
Like it's kind of inappropriate. It's too harsh of a penalty for what the actual infraction was. But let's be honest. This isn't a punishment of the team for this specific incident. This is basically their reputation, and they are now a team that is not going to be able to get the benefit of the doubt or to get away with kind of cutting corners or kind of maybe skirting around the rules. They have to play it by the book, and from all reports, Belichick was supposedly furious when this happened. They claim he had no advance knowledge that this was going on. One interesting note, I read that Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk said that as the NFL was interviewing Patriots staff members, that those staff members kind of got a sense that the NFL was frustrated that they couldn't link this to football operations. So take that for what you will. And again, fans will have different reactions based on their allegiances to that. It is weird that it took 7 months to reach this, but I think ultimately the Patriots have to know they can't get away with anything at this point, and they need to follow the rule every letter of the law.
All right, so with the last couple minutes, let's at least get to some good news. I think you have some.
I do. Cam Newton is now officially a New England Patriot for at least 1 year. We'll see what happens long term. But he signed a deal with the team for the league minimum, but it's loaded with incentives, so he could make up to about $7.5 million this year. I am thrilled to see this. I think a lot of folks were wondering what are the Patriots going to look like on the field without Tom Brady at the helm. Cam Newton is a proven quarterback in this league. It's going to be exciting to see how he fits into this offense.
Now, he's got a big history, right? Former Super Bowl quarterback.
Yeah, league MVP in 2015. Exactly, exactly. So you're talking about a guy that is a premier player, at least was. He's only 31, which is usually about the prime age for a quarterback. He does have a pretty extensive injury history. So that is a concern, and I think that's probably why he ended up signing for the league minimum.
Is that a huge concern, Chris?
Oh, yeah, especially when you're talking about a quarterback like Cam Newton. This is a guy who uses his legs. He runs as much as he throws. He's a very mobile quarterback. That's part of his weapon. And so I think there's always the concern that too many hits, they start to pile up, and eventually, you know, he had a shoulder injury. He broke his foot last year. You start to wonder, okay, is he just every time he gets hit, is he going to get hurt? So that's a concern, but again, the Pats sign him for low money if he does kind of flame out. It's really a low-risk, high-reward kind of move, the kind I think that Belichick really is known for.
What's the team saying?
Well, it's interesting. This just happened last night, so I haven't had a ton of chance to get reactions. But I did notice that the McCourty brothers, Jason and Devin, they were hosting their podcast. They were about to start. It's called Double Coverage. They're about to launch their episode just as the news broke. So they started talking about this a little bit, and I want to play a little bit of Devin's reaction to the signing.
When you add a guy like Cam Newton, it makes our quarterback room even better. We've already spoke about it before, the poise and the jump and the leap you expect for Stiddy to make. And I think it'll be interesting just to training camp and competing and all of that. That's how we all get better.
So interesting notion there. Stiddy is Jarrett Stidham, who is expected to be the starter going into the year. He's thrown four total NFL passes in his entire career. So really an unproven commodity. Devin saying there, hey, the competition is going to make everyone better. Everyone is going to realize they have to step up their game.
All right, so we have a little more information about what the Pats team on the field is going to look like in the fall. In our last 20 seconds, any predictions?
I think, first of all, I think this is a great signing. I think Cam is going to be on the revenge tour. I think you can't undersell that point in sports when there is a player who is out to prove all the naysayers wrong. I think that really does translate to on the field or on the court. And I think that Bill Belichick ultimately is a football mastermind. I think he's going to put a competitive team out there. They're in a fairly weak division. I think they're going to be a playoff team. I think they're probably about 10-6, make the playoffs, and then we'll see it from there.
I'm going to remember you said that. That's Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick.
It's on
Thanks
the record. You got
the score,
tape
Chris.
Now. Thanks for having me.
I got tape.